Today I have with me Mats Plavan. Mats holds a master's degree in physics and is recognized as a world-renowned science and technology reporter. He writes for the Swedish newspaper Ny Teknik, where he has been covering both cold fusion generally and Andrea Rossi's energy catalyzer technology specifically since 2011. He has recently published a book titled An Impossible Invention, in which he recounts his firsthand experiences with Andrea Rossi and LENR over the past 3 years. Mats, thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, Joel. No problem.
Starting off, maybe you can tell us a little more about your general background, your credentials, and your entry into the field of low-energy nuclear reactions.
Right. So, as you said, I've got a Master of Science in Physical Engineering from Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm. I've been working a little bit as an engineer, but quite quickly I turned into journalism because I always liked, telling stories and writing, investigating. All that package attracted me, so I started off as a freelance journalist. And pretty soon, with my background as an engineer, I went into technology and science journalism. And then after a while, I got hired by this publishing company who publishes New Technique, Ny Teknik, or whatever you want, it means new technology. I started off at another newspaper covering mostly information technology. And then I went to the main newspaper of the publishing company, which is New Technology, which has about 300,000 readers, mostly professional engineers. And the circulation is about 150,000 copies. It's quite a big newspaper for being such a small country as Sweden with 9 million inhabitants. In Sweden, it's only in Swedish only, although it has quite a high credibility. We're known for always researching all our articles very, very well. And report accurately on new technology. And our main focus is looking at innovative small startup companies before they, grow as big as maybe an IPO or something. So that's our main focus. We see a lot of those inventors in different fields. We cover every kind of technology. We've got a staff of about 15 reporters. This is a very nice ambience in the newsroom with lots of good people being, specialized in different areas. And I've been working there right now for about, almost 15 years, mostly covering information technology.
What were your general feelings about cold fusion before you started really digging into the topic around 2011? Why do you now believe it's such an important topic, and how did you get personally involved with Andrea Rossi?
Yeah. Regarding cold fusion, I mostly accepted the view that I was served through other news media, that it was an interesting phenomena, but probably there was some kind of mistake in there, somebody had measured something wrong, or some kind of wishful thinking maybe. I had more or less bought that picture because I didn't go very deep into it. And I remember that I briefly had a look at those reports from Department of Energy, those two famous reports that were released when they kind of investigated the situation. And that was more or less what I knew about cold fusion. I know physically the idea behind it, but that was all. And then I got this email from one of our readers who had noticed the demo, the public demo or semi-public demo that Andrea Rossi made in January 2011. And since I happen to speak Italian because my wife is Italian, I just, thought that maybe I could have a look into the sources and do some investigations that would be easier for me to do than my colleagues. So after a day, not even immediately, I had a look at it and I wrote a short piece on our website, not even in the paper newspaper. I didn't think more about that. I think I entitled it Cold Fusion, Now It's Supposed to Be Ready for Production. But quite light-handed, saying that this seems to be the result, we don't know, but this inventor pretends that it seems to work. And the thing was, I had almost forgot about it when I started to look at the reading statistics from the website. And that article bounced away in a way that no other article had ever done before in our website. In a couple of days, or in a couple of weeks maybe, I don't remember exactly, we reached about 100,000 readings on that article, which is like two or three or four times more than any article I had ever had. So I quickly realized that this is an area where our readers are really interested. If this is true, they really want to know more. So I had to go back and start investigating. And that's where I contacted Rossi. Well, I contacted first a couple of physicists here in Sweden that were later involved. If you read the book, Hanno Alfvén, which is a theoretical physicist from the same institution where I got my master's of science, by the way. And then a couple of other researchers. And they didn't just cut it off. They didn't say that it was something strange. On the contrary, Hanno Alfvén, which was the first one I spoke to, said that, well, this is interesting. And then I had to continue to look at it. And after a while, I realized I had to contact author Rossi. So, you know, with my Italian language, I sent away an email to him and asked if I could do an interview with him and Bacardi. From there, it started to get, you know, interesting. I had to just go on. And I started reporting. I did some interviews with Rossi and Bacardi. And I got always the same kind of quite strong reaction, strong interest from our readers. And I just had to go on. So that was the start of the story, so to speak.
Before we dig into other topics surrounding the ECAT technology, would you mind commenting on Andrea Rossi as a person? And beyond his general character, can you provide our listeners with a brief overview of his controversial past and how that slanted perspectives on his research, and ultimately what your conclusions are about that particular time in his life?
Yeah, I'll do that. Could I first just add one more thing regarding your last question? Because you asked me why I then got interested in cold fusion. Well, the thing is that quite quickly with my knowledge in physics, I understood that this phenomenon could be possible. I couldn't exclude right away that it was impossible. And I started to dig into the history of cold fusion. I understood that the picture that I had observed not necessarily was the true picture. And added to the fact that if cold fusion really works with that high energy density that it has as a nuclear power reaction, and not having the disadvantages of the nuclear power reactions we know, the fusion and the fission, it would be so useful, extremely useful as an energy source that, I mean, it was interesting in itself. So basically that was several other reasons that made me continue my investigation, my research and my work around reporting around cold fusion. So that was the answer to the last question. Let's go to what you're asking me now about Andrea Rossi. So first of all, his character is kind of, you know, a particular person. But if you have met other inventors, he kind of fits into that picture of persons who are breaking new ground. And they're not like all other persons. They're not like all of us. Because to be able to break new ground, you've got to have a very strong personality to go where no one else has gone before. And in that sense, Ross is not so unusual as you might think when you read about him for the first time. You know, he believes in what he does, and once he's found something that he really believes in, he goes on very stubbornly on that track, and he might have difficulties listening to others. But those are characteristics that I can see. I've seen other times with inventors that we have covered in regarding other technologies that have no technique in my work. So in that sense, he's, yeah, a strong personality, but he fits into the picture. Then he's got all those stories in his background that people tend to pick up when they first hear about him and say he must be a fraudster. The main story is that the first one he went into in the 80s about producing oil from biological waste, mainly tires, actually. Organic waste, I should say. And the thing about that is, well, he went into prison. That's what everybody knows. The longer story is that, first of all, the technology in itself is not so strange. There is actually a Swedish startup company called Cassandra Oil, which ironically happened to be involved in this book, because the Swedish persons involved in that company went down to measure Andrea Rossi's ECAT at one moment, interested in investing in its technology. That's kind of a strange coincidence. So the same technology that Rossi used in the 80s is now developed, and it's called depolymerization or something like that, when you turn matter like what you have in tires into oil in a certain process. So it was not an impossible invention that he was looking at, only that he was kind of a pioneer in that area. If he did it today, it would be regarded as clean tech or something similar. But when he did it, it was quite new, and it was definitely a challenge to several other activities in the world, specifically in Italy. Apart from being a challenge towards the oil industry, petroleum industry, it was also a challenge against the organized crime organizations that are well connected to the handling of waste in many countries, specifically in Italy. So he actually had two main interests against him. That's his only explanation why everything went in a difficult direction for him, because people really didn't want him to go on. So he had strong interests against him. They tried to get at him in many ways. And in the end, first time he really got into prison was when he was accused for handling gold and silver on the black market going into Switzerland, I think. And that was basically a company that he had initially trying to extract metals like gold and silver and other metals from waste like photographic film and stuff like that. And in the end, it turned out that it was a perfectly legal activity that he had, but it was enough to put him into prison. And when he was into prison, they could attack his company and he couldn't go on with his activities as he should. And he had deposed of organic waste that was leaking, and that became a hazard to the environment. And probably all those things was also because he was kind of, I think, you know, a young inventor, kind of naive. He made a lot of mistakes. But to me, all that story turns out to be a possible explanation of the troubles he got into. In the end, he was only accused, or he was only, what do you say, sentenced for economic crimes in the bankruptcy. That was the end of his activities at that time. So all the other charges were taken away in the end. And if you look at that story, it's difficult in a country like Italy, where it's quite a non-transparent country. Things are not what you believe them to be when you look at them at first. But it's a believable explanation of the troubles he got into at that time. So it's not necessarily, I think not necessarily that you should draw the conclusion from his past that he's a fraudster because he went into prison. You should look deeper into that story and try to understand what could have happened at that time. My conclusion is that it's a possible difficulty that he got into as a young inventor in a pioneer environment at that time.
Right. I think there's a lot of nuance to those kinds of situations. And even in America, nothing is as it appears on a surface level, especially in the mainstream media. Things are portrayed in a very black and white, melodramatic sort of way that is not actually how reality works. And this is not a conspiracy necessarily or anything like that, but the truth is there's always vying interests in any kind of enterprise. And there's winners and losers in those situations, and oftentimes the other side tries to villainize the other side. And mainstream news media, especially now, investigative journalism is not what it used to be. Funds are not directed in that direction like they used to be. So there's very little actual deep journalism going on. So I think, like you said, you actually have to look at the nuance a bit deeper before you draw any conclusions than to just dismiss somebody because of mistakes they've made. And we're going to get into a little more about this idea of inventor's disease later on, but like you said, these types of people are not your usual people, and they go forward and sometimes make mistakes, even though it's really just a result of naivete rather than any kind of nefarious activity. So, but moving beyond that, can you explain to us a bit how the ECAT technology works in principle, as far as your understanding goes, and why have you been convinced that the ECAT's a legitimate technology?
Okay, so let's start with the basic principles. Of course, in the end, they're not known. Cold fusion is not an explained technology because there are theories, there are suggestions for theories, but there is no proof for those theories being valid. So we don't know exactly. But the thing is that you should first understand those experiments that have been done within cold fusion and low energy nuclear reactions, as well as those demos that had been done with Andrea Rossi technology, although I admit immediately that they have been done, most of them, in a sloppy way with lots of possible error. But they all indicate a heat development which is beyond what you can explain with a chemical reaction. Now, you have to understand that there are two kinds of exothermal reactions in the world. Exothermal is when you have a reaction that releases energy. You have chemical reactions. Those are the absolute majority of all exothermal reactions because they go on everywhere from the combustion engine to what happens inside your body. Chemical reactions happen when you have electrons moving from one atom to another and bounding in different ways. Now, then you have nuclear reactions. Nuclear reactions are reactions when the nucleus of the atom is involved. And the particular thing about nuclear reactions is that from the same amount of matter, the same amount of fuel, you get about a million times more energy from a nuclear reaction than from a chemical reaction. So it's much more effective. It's much more energy dense, as you say. And when you have those experiments, when you see that you have a certain thermal release and you measure the quantity of fuel you have, you can, from the amount of thermal energy that goes out from the reaction, you can, if it's more than what you can explain with a chemical reaction, it should be a nuclear reaction. And in all those experiments, that's the case. You have many times more energy than what you could explain with a chemical reaction. So that's why you conclude that it must be a nuclear reaction. Now, nuclear reactions, exothermal nuclear reactions, we all know basically two of them. That's fusion that you have in the sun and in the hydrogen bomb, thermonuclear bomb, and we can't control it on Earth in enough way. And then you have fission, which is what goes on in nuclear plants. where you have big nucleus that you divide by bombarding them with neutrons. And the reason this works is because there's a maximum, that's a perfect dimension of the nucleus, which is what you have in iron, where the nucleus is most stable. And everything goes towards that direction. So big nucleus want to go towards iron, and small nucleus want to go towards iron. So that's why fusion of small nucleus and fission of big nucleus works. What you see in cold fusion doesn't fit into this picture. But on the other hand, you should remember that nuclear science is a science that has only 100 years. It's only 100 years old, more or less, when we discovered radioactivity for the first time in the end of the 19th century. So it's not so strange. There could be areas in nuclear science that are not known to us yet. And that's the main reaction that I have got from physicists that I've been talking to that are positive to this. They say that, well, you know, there are lots of things we don't really know. Lots of areas inside nuclear science where we have a knowledge that, which is not actually complete, or we couldn't pretend to have a complete knowledge. And what's happening in cold fusion, what could happen is that should be some kind of interaction. In this case, when we're speaking about Rosses technology, what you have inside the reactor that we know is that you have nickel, which is a metal, which is very abundant on Earth, and then you have hydrogen gas. Hydrogen is the most common element in the universe, and it's present in water in the water molecule. So you have those elements, and then Andrea Rossi says that he has some kind of catalyst inside of it. What we don't know exactly what these are, if they are elements or chemical compounds or something else that could be regarded as a catalyst. And supposedly, in this way, he has made this reaction work better than any of the cold fusion researchers have managed to do in the last 25 years since Fleischmann and Pons in 1989. What Fleischmann and Pons, those famous two scientists in Utah University, used was another process where they have a palladium, and they did some electrolysis that they have of the heavy water, so they got heavy hydrogen or deuterium inside the palladium. And they thought that inside there, those hydrogen atoms or nucleus, they got so close to each other that it would have fusion. But we don't know if it's really a fusion process, if it should be called cold fusion. There are many other suggestions about what could be going on. What we know is that it should be a nuclear reaction. Many scientists believe that there are lots of different ways of obtaining these kind of nuclear reactions, which is not those nuclear reactions that we immediately think of, fission or fusion. And exactly what goes on inside the ECAD, if it works, or in other low-energy nuclear reactions, we don't know. It could be, it should be some kind of nuclear reaction, since it has so much thermal output compared to the very little amount of fuel that you put into it. What Rossi has, basically, in any case, is this powder of nickel. You've got hydrogen gas released from what now he says some kind of material which stores hydrogen, metal hydride, for example. And then he heats the reaction. He starts it by heating the fuel, and he regulates it also by heating it. And it seems to be reaction. If I take the information that I've got and whatever I had studied regarding this, it seems to be kind of reaction that tends to run away at a certain point. And if it runs away, it quickly rises at the melting point of nickel, and then the reactor, the fuel gets destroyed. So the difficulty in that case should be to push it in a certain way, not too much, but push it in a right amount to keep it going without letting it run away. That could be the difficulty of handling this reaction if it really gets working. So that's basically the principle behind the reaction. The reason that I believe that it actually is a valid technology, in my book, I push it quite hard. I say in the last chapter that I'm always convinced it's working. Now, my intention with the book is to let the reader decide for himself or herself and make his or her own picture of this. In the end, I say that I'm quite convinced it's working. Of course, you still have to have much better measurements to really prove that it's working. And I admit that I could be wrong. We could find out there could be some kind of systematic error in those measurements that explains the measurements of thermal energy. So it maybe didn't work at all. It worked much less than we thought. But the basic things, apart from the one measurement that was made by the Italian-Swedish group, and basically in March 2012, that was published later as a report that was got quite a lot of interest by Levy and Essain as main authors, that was made in quite an accurate way. There are still possibilities of error inside it, but I believe that's an important report. But apart from that measurement, and those measurements, quite sloppy measurements that I made myself, those situations that people have told me about, when the reaction has been running away, that has impressed me. Testimonials about the old ECAD with water boiling inside, that they couldn't stop it. It was almost exploding. one moment, and not only Rossi told me about this, but two or three other persons that were present. Rossi's own story is about when the reactor has exploded of pressure inside, and also some testimonials by when they used the hot cat. It run, the reaction run away, and the steel and the ceramics inside actually melted. The steel actually didn't only melt, it burned, if you look at the edges of the steel material. Of course, I was not present. These are things that people have told me, so I cannot guarantee that they are true. But there are so many of them that I give them some importance. And then there's one situation also that when I was present, when the ECAT was going on, that was 6th October, 7th October of 2011, a public demo with lots of people. And Rossi left the reactor going on for 4 hours in self-sustained mode without any energy input, basically. And even though, you know, pumping in water continuously in that reactor for 4 hours, after 4 hours, it was still about 80 degrees Celsius on the outside, very hot, or 60 or 80. And I could feel it boil inside. And after almost 4 hours when he opened it, it was obvious it was as hot as boiling temperature inside. And that's difficult to explain if you pump in water for 4 hours. So, you know, in the end, it's not the actual measurements that have made me convinced. It's rather those situations when the reaction has gone, run away, and that situation when I saw that reaction going on, self-sustained 4 hours, and still being so hot in the air.
Now, as far as you are aware, where does progress on the ECAT currently stand, and what's your opinion on Rossi's current partner, Industrial Heat, in the United States?
Well, I know very little about Industrial Heat. I've contacted them, but they have not responded to my request for contact. I never talked to them, so I really know nothing about them except for the press release that they sent out in the beginning of this year. I'm not really sure that they actually have much of a personnel or expertise in this area. And it might be that Ross is going on with his development more or less on by his own and with a couple of few other persons as before. And that kind of worries me, because I would say that we've come to a point now where you have to see product development starting and see something more substantial happening in the development of the product than before. You just can't go on doing experiments and try to convince people with not too accurate demos that the technology is working. You have to start develop products. But really, at this very moment, it's a good thing that he's got a partner, because he was too much on his own for a long time. And this I say from general point of view about inventors and what I've seen from other inventors. But I don't have any detailed knowledge about the actual position of the technology right now, where Andrea Rossi has arrived.
What are your perspectives on the other commercial players in the LENR field, including Defcalion, Brillouin, and you also have Blacklight Power?
Yeah, actually, I've not looked sufficiently at any of them to be able to have an opinion on their technology. I've just, you know, have a general interest in their activities, and being technologies that seem to have something in common with Rossi's that I've studied much more, it's interesting to see that they're working with it and they claim to have good results. It's a particular situation with Defcalion that I actually have had lots of doubts from the point that they claim to have developed their own technology after that Rossi had ended the agreement with them. You know, probably know that Defcalion initially were supposed to develop devices and appliances with Rossi's technology as the heat source. So they didn't have any knowledge about the heat source itself. And when Rossi ended the contract, a few months, they claimed that they continued their operations and they had found a way to create a similar reaction based on nickel and hydrogen. But every time that they promised to publish some results, some measurements, some values, at the end they didn't give me anything, and they haven't published anything except theories until they did a demo in Milan in July last year, where I was present. And even then, I came as an observer, and they asked me to get in the picture as kind of having a more active role of controlling the situation, and I wasn't prepared to that, but I did my best. But I felt that what they presented to me was quite untransparent, and I didn't feel that I really had a control of what they were presenting to me, even though they said that I could cut wires, do whatever I want. And after that, I know that Defcalion's Italian partners, a company called MOSI in Italy, which was part of the joint venture of Defcalion Europe, they stopped all commercial activities because they had questions that were unanswered. I think they have an investigation going on about the technology. And I don't feel comfortable about that situation. I must say that, unfortunately, I have had lots of reasons to have strong doubts about what Defcalion really has, if they have any technology at all.
Based on your experience covering cold fusion now for about 3 years, What do you now see as some of the major problems with contemporary science journalism? Why do so many people in the mainstream continue to disregard this topic or simply write it off as pathological science?
This is an interesting topic. I'm not sure that the general problem with science journalism is such a particular domain in science, because anytime you touch something that is so new and so outside of the box, it's actually difficult to cover in general. And I think in journalism in general tends to stick to the referring method when you refer different opinions from different parties. And you present them and you let the audience or the readers draw their own conclusions. I think that science journalism does that as well, because specifically because it's difficult to have more knowledge than those researchers that you're relating to. They have got such a deep knowledge in their field that you couldn't actually question what they're saying. You could just refer what they're reporting, and specifically you could refer what science magazine reports, because then you have the mechanism with peer review. The problem is, of course, when you go into a field where there are strong opinions about what's possible and what's not. And specifically in science, when you touch a subject where there is no theory, when you only have experimental results, that tends to be very difficult. Because as long as you have a theory, it's just fine. Everyone is happy, because what you have to do is confirm theory with an experiment. And when the experiment confirms the theory, it was just what you expected. So that's kind of the Higgs boson situation. You had this theory, you just had to find the boson, and when you finally did, of course, it was a Nobel Prize, and everyone was happy. But when you start the other way around, and you find some strange experimental results, and you don't have any theory to back them up with, scientists are generally getting very uncomfortable. And you shouldn't expect science journalists to oppose those scientists, because they have such a deep knowledge about their area, of course. But still, what I think about journalism in general is that when you get to a subject, when you start to feel that what the picture you're being served is not necessarily an accurate picture of reality, you feel that it might be biased or it might be something else hidden behind it, then either you stick to the referring method and you go on, like, you know, referring what people say. But at that point, that becomes kind of a hiding, in my opinion. What you should do as a journalist in that situation is start investigating and make your own conclusions and make your own investigation. And lots of journalists in other areas are much better than me at this. They really do it in an extraordinary manner. It's quite rare, though, that you do it in science journalism, because then you've got the situation with the researchers knowing much more than you do. Because even in my case, I got a Master of Science in Physics Engineering. I'm far away from the knowledge of those scientists that are opposing cold fusion. Putting together one-on-one and getting back to the story of cold fusion and looking into what other people have found investigating the story, it's not so difficult with the basic knowledge in physics to understand that something might be wrong here. The picture that is served publicly might not be the whole truth. And I think that as a science journalist in that situation, you should build your own opinion and report it. But I know it's difficult. It's very controversial. And in this case, I've been sticking up my neck quite a bit, I think.
Why do you think it's still termed pathological science? Is there still leftover prejudice from the 89 fiasco? Has that never left the public consciousness? Or do you think it goes deeper than that?
Well, no. In the end, I think it's basic group thinking and sociological reasons for this. Because it appears to me, when I speak to persons that have studied this much more than I have, that those who oppose cold fusion in general, they have not studied all the papers that have been published confirming that the Fleischmann-Pons effect, for example, has been reproduced like 100 times in peer-reviewed papers. So it's more kind of a group thinking. When it was presented and rejected in 89, the reaction was so strong that people tend to not touch it. It feels safer not to touch it, not dig into it, and go with the group thinking. So I think the explanation is quite, you know, it's all there. There's no more deeper reason of conspiracy or something like that I could explain it. I think the explanation is quite simple in the end. People tend to stick to the safe opinion and not dig into it too much. And added to that is, of course, that also media was burned at the time, because they published, you know, on the first papers, Time magazine and other newspapers about this fantastic reaction that would save the world, the fantastic energy source. And when a couple of months later, when the science community decided that this was probably wishful thinking and pathological science, I think also media was burned in that situation. And after that, not only the science community, but also media is afraid of touching it because it's been so stigmatized. And I feel also, I mean, even in my own newsroom, some people are afraid of my reporting, or they feel uncomfortable with my reporting because still it's quite a sensitive subject.
I agree. I think it's largely a cultural issue. Culturally, we build our worldview around narratives. And once a narrative has been hammered home, people tend to stick to it. Like you said, they take the safe route. And because largely we are societies built on specialists, experts, and taking their opinions to heart, like you just mentioned, people have a hard time questioning those opinions. Even though when you dig really deep, you can see the flaws in them, people are afraid. There's a fear, a discomfort of questioning that authority. So I think there's a strong conditioning component that goes along with the inability to recognize something as a reality, or the inability to, again, question authority. So I think you're spot on in that regard. All right, moving on a little bit. You speak in your book about something that I brought up a little earlier. You call it inventor's disease. Can you elaborate some more on what that is exactly and how you think it hinders the progress of milestone technologies from achieving their full potential?
Well, yeah, that's something that we witness regularly at New Technique, reporting on new inventions. And that's a tendency of this very strong character that you also often find in inventors, believing in their own thing. And they have a number of typical reactions, like, you know, the invention is their own baby, don't let anyone else touch it. And they think that if they're good inventors, they also think that they're good entrepreneurs building a company, but usually they're not. And they have a tendency to want to solve everything themselves instead of pulling in other competences of people that, you know, normally to build a company you need, apart from technology specialists, you would need a person which is good at marketing, another person good at economics, another person that is a good leader, can be the CEO of a company. And unless you have that, you know, when you build a company, you admit that you need those other competences to have a group to get forward with the technology. If you don't admit that, you probably won't reach the market. And one other mistake that most inventors do, or many inventors do, is the belief that the good technology sells itself. It won't, because you really have to understand what problem it solves. You have to build a product and you have to get to market with it. And most inventors are not good at that. But these are, you know, general observations that we do from time to time. And this story, I think it's a little bit different. Even though Andrea Rossi fits into that picture, the potential in this technology, if it works, it's so enormous that you have lots of people, of course, trying to take advantage of you, trying to steal the technology or get control of it, or understand it to use somewhere else out of your control. And I believe that some people tend to think that Ross is paranoid, trying to defend himself from those kind of persons around him. But maybe I think that he was severely burned in his earlier story, and that gave him some kind of experience that might, if this works, this might have really helped him to handle the enormous potential that you have in this technology and handle the people around him. It might have been good. We don't know that yet. It might have been good. It might have been bad. But I don't think you could actually apply what happens in this story to all kinds of other more kind of normal inventions that are made every day around us, because they fit into a regular pattern, which is smoother going from technology to market. The forces that you have around a technology with such a huge potential as this one is different. You couldn't actually draw conclusions from what Rossi should have done compared to inventing other technologies and bringing them to market. It's not that easy, I don't think.
So earlier this year, Swedish professor Sven Kulander passed away. Can you comment a bit on the role he and Hanno Essen played in heightening awareness of the ECAT, and maybe what the response of their peers in academia was to them being involved in this area of research?
Okay, yeah. So basically it was me who pulled in Essen and Kulander. I invited them to our newsroom to have a discussion about this technology in general. And before I did that, I asked them if they wanted to send some questions to Rossi. And they did. So they pulled together a couple of questions and they sent them to Rossi, who answered them. From there, there was a kind of exchange of opinions and discussions going on between them. To my surprise, I didn't know when I pulled in Calandra that he had a background in cold fusion as well. Not actually as a researcher, but he had been supporting a research work here in Sweden by a Japanese professor called Ikegami, together with Roland Petterson, which is mentioned in the book as well. And he was supporting that research. Yeah, so he had an interest in this kind of technology as an experimentalist as well. And after I pulled them into the story, they decided that they wanted to go down. Maybe a little bit surprising to me, because they took that initiative themselves, more even though they were invited by Ross, but they were immediately interested in going down. And they acted as observers at one demo that Ross did. But I was even more surprised when they came back and wrote their travel report from that demo, because it was astonishingly positive. Where they stated in the beginning of the report that this must be a nuclear reaction. And that report had, I think, great influence on the discussions going on after that, because it was made by those two Swedish professors of whom one, Calandra, was part of the committee of the Swedish Royal Academics of Science Academy, which is responsible for the Nobel Prizes in Chemistry and Physics. So, of course, that had a great influence. What they experienced after that, I had, of course, a continued dialogue with them, both of them, and they were, maybe you should say, attacked by colleagues in their institutions in Sweden. They were very questioned, but they always kind of told me about this with a good humor. They were not really, it didn't seem to me that they felt threatened. They took it kind of as a challenge, and they repeated to me that, well, you know, they said this and I answered that, and I think that those people should look deeper into this because I think it's still interesting and we have to know more about it. And the important thing is to gain more knowledge about it, because could be something. We don't know. It could be something. And as a researcher, I want to know more. So they had a very kind of pragmatic relationship to the subject itself. And in that way, I think they defended themselves also from the attacks from their peers in their institutions. For me personally, that also meant a lot. Calandra was an extremely positive person. He was really a nice person, always having the kind of positive energy that, well, you know, we have these problems, but I want to know more. This is so interesting. I would really like to know what's happening inside here. So I would like to do more in this future.
And that's something that really strikes me about many academics, is the lack of curiosity or the closed-mindedness, or even if not that, just the aggressiveness with which they attack claims. I think as scientists or as scientific-minded people, the entire premise of the enterprise is to investigate without prejudice and to not let the past influence the present. And oftentimes, you don't see that being subscribed to. They are very much acting like normal people, where they're letting their past memories or their prejudices influence how they perceive a subject. And while you can certainly raise questions about measurements or this or that, that's fine. But to be an armchair critic without actually asking the questions, talking to the people that are the preeminent investigators and scientists and inventors, engaging with the literature, so often these things are not done. And so I feel like science and the scientific establishment is letting people down in that sense. Not to say that it's completely wrong, it's just given into dogma a little bit. So I'm always happy and refreshed to see people like Kulander, who I believe he was the head of the Swedish Skeptic Society, is that correct?
No, that was actually, it was the head of the Swedish Skeptic Society. It used to be it, and they changed roles, and there's another person in charge now. But Calandra, no, his role was in the Swedish Academy of Science. But I totally agree what you're saying. And one thing that I've been thinking of in this story is that, you know, people tend to think that in life in general, what happens depends much on people's self-interest or opinions or this or that. It's never black or white. But they tend to believe that maybe science is a pure area where only the scientific truth rules and we know what's right or wrong. It's kind of a, you know, fairy tale. And what I'm thinking after being through this story is that scientists are like all the rest of us. We're influenced by our character, and some people are curious, other people are afraid towards the new. And that influences very much your way of working as a scientist as well. And I agree with you, it's strange though, in the end, that you question the very involvement in something. I mean, I can't understand why you could criticize researchers being involved in investigating something. As you say, they could criticize the methods or the measurements, but I mean, you couldn't criticize your interest for being involved because you want to know more about them. That's a very strange attitude, I think. But in the end, probably you have to accept that scientists are also, like the rest of us, persons with their good and bad sides. And we have characters, and that what's influenced our way of working.
So before we wrap up, can you tell us about any new projects or announcements beside your book that we can expect from you in the near future?
I'm just quite exhausted after 3 years of writing this book. By the way, kind of, behind closed doors while also working 4 days a week, actually, as a journalist at New Technique and then, family life and everything else. So at the moment, I haven't even started thinking about new projects and new announcements. I think I'm going to have to let some time pass before I start to think about what I could do ahead, like a project of a new book or something. Talking about a new book, I mean, the only reason for writing a new book about this story is that I should have information that could be so interesting to write about that they actually add something to what the readers already know. And I don't know if I'm going to have that kind of information. We're going to see about that. So, what I'm doing right now is just leaning back for a moment and looking at the reactions of the book and see what happens now.
Well, Matt, thank you very much for spending some time with me today. It's been a very interesting conversation. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, John.